expect you to be perfect in bed or out of it.
Bless you for that. He kissed her slowly, sighing when she pulled away to nest in his arms. But that doesn't mean I shouldn't try.
Well, if you insist, there is something you could do for me.
Gabriel moved so quickly, Julia was torn between shock and the urge to laugh. But as soon as he touched her, she stopped laughing. Later that evening, Gabriel lay on his back in the center of the bed, underneath the mosquito netting. Julia rested her head just below his pectorals, her arm wrapped around his waist. "Are you happy?" His voice came out of the candle-soaked darkness as he ran his fingers over the top of her head and down to trace the curve of her neck.
"Yes. Are you?"
"More than I ever thought I could be." Julia smiled against his chest and kissed the skin there.
"Things seem different since we came back from Italy," he prompted, his hand still gliding across neck and shoulder. "We have a lot to be grateful for. We have each other. I have Harvard. Dr. Nicole has been helping me. I feel like I'm finally putting the pieces back together."
"Good," he whispered. "And the way that we make love, in general? You're happy with that?"
Now Julia lifted her head so she could gaze up into his concerned blue eyes.
"Of course," she laughed quietly.
"You can't tell?"
"I can tell that I please your body, but your body is not your mind or your heart."
He seemed embarrassed, and Julia repented of her decision to laugh.
"Tonight was an aberration. But even if it wasn't, I'm sure we'd work through it."
"Are you happy with the way we make love?" She sounded shy.
"Yes, very much. I feel it changing. I feel the connection deepening."
He shrugged. "I just wondered if you felt it too."
"Sometimes I think this is a dream. Believe me, I'm happy."
She leaned up to kiss him, and then rested her head on his chest again.
"Why are you asking me these things?"
"Where do you see yourself in the future?"
"I want to be a professor. I want to be with you."
Julia's voice was on the quiet side, but remarkably assertive. He began threading the sheet in between his fingers.
"Wouldn't you rather find a nice man who could give you children?"
"You can't ask me if I'm happy with one breath and push me away with the next." When he didn't respond, she gently took hold of his chin, forcing his eyes to hers.
"No, I don't want to find a nice man to have a child with. I want a child with you."
Gabriel stared at her incredulously, his blue eyes widening.
"Truthfully, I don't know if we'll ever get to the point where we're healthy enough to open our home to a child. But if we do, I'm sure we'll find a little boy or girl who is supposed to be our child. Grace and Richard adopted you. We can do the same."
Her face grew pained.
"Unless you decide you don't want that. Or you don't want that with me."
"Of course I want you." The intensity of his voice matched his eyes. "I'd like to make promises to you. But I want us to wait a little before we have that conversation. Does that trouble you?"
He reached out a finger to toy with the diamond in her ear.
Julia didn't need a narrator to understand what his physical gesture meant.
"No.
I don't want you to think that any hesitation on my part is due to lack of feeling." Gabriel gave voice to her unspoken fear.
"I'm yours. All of me. And I'm so glad we won't be apart next year. The thought of losing you was torturous."
He nodded as if he understood.
"Now come here, Julia, so I can worship you."
Chapter 20
"Miss Mitchell."
The tall, dark-haired woman in the power suit strolled into the corner office, shook Julia's hand, and sat behind her large desk. Miss Soraya Harandi was of Iranian descent, with light, unfreckled skin and cascades of blue-black hair. Her mouth was wide and full, and her dark eyes sparkled. She was not necessarily beautiful,
but she was striking, and Julia could not help but stare.
Soraya chuckled.
Julia immediately looked down at her book bag and began to fidget with it.
"Now that's something you cannot do in front of the dean. No matter what he says or does, you cannot look away. It makes you look guilty and weak."
Soraya softened her criticism with a smile.
"Law is as much about psychology as it is about precedent. Now why don't you tell me what led up to the dean's letter?"
Julia took a deep breath and told her story, beginning when she was 17 and ending with the letter from the dean's office. She only left out a few details.
Soraya listened carefully, jotting down notes on her laptop and nodding on occasion.
When Julia finished, Soraya was quiet for a moment.
"That's quite a story. Since the dean hasn't disclosed what the complaint is about, let's not assume it's about your boyfriend, although we should prepare for that scenario. Was your relationship with Professor Emerson absolutely consensual?"
"Of course."
"Have you ever had a sexual relationship with one of your professors or teaching assistants before?"
"No."
"Is it possible he seduced you solely for his own amusement?"
"Of course not. Gabriel loves me."
Soraya appeared relieved.
"Good. Well, good for you personally. Not so good depending on the complaint."
"What do you mean?"
"If your relationship was consensual, then the university can pursue disciplinary action against both of you. If you were a victim, then they'll only pursue him."
"I am not a victim. We are in a relationship, and we waited until after the semester was over before we became involved."
"No, you didn't."
Julia was incredulous.
"Excuse me?
According to your story, you had an amorous relationship with him beginning around the end of October. You waited until after the semester was over to sleep with him, but given the way the non-fraternization policy is written, you violated it. Who knows about your relationship?"
"His family? My father? That's it."
"What about the student who accused your boyfriend of sexual harassment?"
Julia gritted her teeth.
"I don't know what she knows, but she hates me."
Soraya tapped her chin with her pen.
"If you were accused of violating the non-fraternization policy, what kind of evidence, other than your testimony, could you offer for the fact that you weren't having a sexual relationship with him while you were his student? Why would you think the complaint has to do with Gabriel? The academic conduct policy covers things like plagiarism."
"I've met Dean Arris. He doesn't waste his precious time with plagiarism cases."
Julia sat back in her chair.
"Oh, my God.
Let's hope someone is accusing you of a minor academic offense and that Dean Arris is simply taking a personal interest in your case. But just in case, what kind of evidence can you offer to prove you weren't trading sex for grades?"
Julia flushed deeply. There is something."
"What is it?"
"I was a virgin before we went to Italy."
Soraya stared at her as if she was a mythical creature, such as, say, a heterosexual man who knows the difference between Manolo Blahnik and Christian Louboutins.
"Do you have medical proof of that? Such as a doctor's note?"
Julia squirmed.
"No."
"Then there's no point in bringing it up. Did anyone from the university see you and Gabriel together during the semester?"
"Not as far as I know, although we went to a dance club with his sister back in September."
Soraya pursed her lips.
"Bringing up the fact that you are a friend of his family is not a good idea. It establishes a possible conflict of interest, and being seen in his company in a public venue was not an intelligent choice, Miss Mitchell. But frankly, he bears more blame than you because he should have known better. Since we don't know the nature of the complaint, our strategy should be to gather as much information as possible from the meeting while giving nothing away. That will buy us time to prepare for any disciplinary proceedings should they arise. Hopefully they won't. At the meeting with the dean, I will speak for you. Since they haven't disclosed the nature of the complaint, it's possible that the complaint is specious, and that they know this. We won't add fuel to their funeral pyre."
Soraya looked at Julia's downcast face and frowned.
"You have to have confidence. You have to believe that the complaint is frivolous and that you've done nothing wrong. I've had dealings with the university's judiciary before, and I was fairly successful.
I will be successful with your case, too.
Julia took small comfort in Soraya's confidence, but some comfort was better than nothing. In the meantime, I would like a list of anyone who might have filed a complaint against you and why, and a detailed account of all your interactions with Miss Peterson. I'll have one of my assistants perform some background checks. I'll also place a call to a contact of mine at the university and see what I can find out. Until this matter is settled, you and Professor Emerson need to cool it. Don't be seen in public together. Don't talk to him about what you and I discuss. If the complaint is about fraternization, he will have his own counsel, who will look after his interests. I don't want my defense of you compromised by your pillow talk. Julia's eyes flashed with a momentary heat.
Gabriel is much more than just a boyfriend. If I'm in danger, so is he. Our relationship was consensual, and I have no interest in being defended at his expense. Any blame we have is equal between us.
Soraya gazed at Julia curiously.
Are you sure that's his position?
You told my secretary that John Green is Gabriel's attorney. Why isn't John representing you if you and Gabriel are determined to show a united front? Julia opened her mouth to form an answer, but none occurred to her. Soraya smiled sympathetically.
Listen, you aren't the first student to find herself in this situation. I'm sure it's upsetting and confusing, but you need to realize that if the complaint against you and your boyfriend escalates, it's quite possible he will break things off with you in order to protect his job. You need to prepare yourself in case he decides to throw you to the wolves.
He would never do that. He loves me. We're talking about moving in together and other things. Soraya gave her a condescending look.
Love can be easily killed, especially by unemployment. But let's take things one step at a time. Gabriel has sent over a retainer, which I will return. I think it's best for me to represent you pro bono.
Julia nodded uncomfortably. She had forgotten about the legal fees.
I will pay you, but it might take some time. The point of taking a case for the good is so one can further the good. I don't see much good coming out of taking your money. You should be spending it on textbooks and moving expenses to Massachusetts.
Soraya's smile tightened.
I am not a fan of the university's sexual inquisitions. Anything I can do to embarrass or humiliate Dean Arris is definitely for the good. Believe me, representing your interest will be one of the few pleasures I've had recently. I should be paying you for the privilege.
Later that evening, Julia was curled up into a ball trying to sleep in Gabriel's bed. He was in his study, furiously researching all the university policies that applied to graduate students, trying to figure out what had possibly come to the attention of the dean. The thought of Gabriel having to do that for her, the thought of his career possibly being threatened because of her, combined with the possibility of losing Harvard, made the tears come. It was all so overwhelming, and the worst part was not knowing what the specific danger was. She wiped the tears away, willing herself to be strong. Gabriel walked into the bedroom to check on her, and upon seeing her face, slipped into bed behind her.
"Don't cry, sweetheart. Please don't cry."
He paused. "I wouldn't have continued working if I'd known you were so upset. We've hired the best lawyer, and we're going to fight this complaint. It's quite possible it's simply a misunderstanding, and by Friday evening it will all be over."
"What if this is about us?"
Gabriel clenched his teeth. "Then we'll deal with it together."
"What about the harassment complaint?"
"Don't worry about that. You focus on your thesis and your studies, and you let me worry about myself. I'm not going to let anyone hurt you, I promise." He rolled her onto her back and began sweeping soft kisses across her face.
"I'm afraid," she whispered.
Gabriel stroked her hair and pressed a kiss to the tip of her nose.
"I know.
But no matter what, I won't let them keep you from Harvard. It's going to be fine." He gave her a pained look.
"What can I do, Julia? I don't know how to comfort you. Kiss me."
Gabriel kissed her mouth, the hesitant, light kiss of a boy who was unsure how the girl next door would react. He needn't have worried. Julia responded by wrapping his hair around her fingers and pulling his lips to hers, kissing him fiercely, and coaxing his tongue into her mouth. He kissed her back, but with restraint, then pulled away before pressing their foreheads together.
"I can't," he said.
"Please."
She tugged at him, running her hands across his broad shoulders and down the sinews of his back, pulling him toward her.
"I can't make love to you while you're sad. I would feel like I was hurting you."
"But I need you."
"Wouldn't you rather I ran a hot bath or something?
Making love with you makes me happy because it reminds me how much you love me. Please, I need to feel like you want me."
His eyebrows knitted together.
"Of course I want you, Julia. I just don't want to take advantage."
She was not the sort of woman who made many demands, and what demands she made were almost always good, and almost always about what was good for him. Gabriel knew this, and it pained him to deny her in those large, sad brown eyes. But the trails of her tears had dampened his libido. He would far rather have held her tightly and tried to soothe her by being close than to attempt an act he would not be able to perform. Her face told him that she needed him, that she needed this and them, and the conjunction of body and soul. While he stroked her hair, deciding what to do, he realized something about himself. No matter what his therapist had intimated, he was not a sex addict. He was not a wanton hedonist with a massive hunger who was willing to, as Scott had put it, screw anything female and attractive. Julianne had changed him. He loved her, and even if she begged him, he couldn't become aroused while seeing her in pain. She was still staring at him, her fingers tracing up and down his naked back. He decided to give her part of what she wanted. To touch and caress her, focusing on distracting her with pleasurable feelings and sensations, hoping that it would be enough. He kissed her, slowing their pace to a gentle exploration. She ran her fingers through his hair, anchoring him to her as she softly scratched his scalp. Even in the midst of her sorrow and need, she was kind. He feathered his lips to her neck and her ear, where he whispered about how much she'd changed him. How much happier he was now that she was his. She began to sigh as he adored her neck, dipping a playful tongue into the hollow at the base of her throat before kissing it chastely. He nipped at her collarbones, gently pulling aside the thin strap of her tank top, so the white slope of his shoulder was bare to his mouth. She would have removed her tank top for him, exposing her breasts, but he stopped her.
"Patience," he whispered.
He wound their fingers together and kissed the back of her hand, extending her arm so he could draw the flesh of her inner elbow into his mouth, pausing when she began to moan. He kissed every inch of her, gliding strong hands across soft skin, taking his cue from the heat that shot across her flesh and the sounds that escaped her lips. When he was satisfied that her tears had stopped, and she was asking him for more, he cast their clothes aside and knelt between her legs. Soon she was shaking and crying out his name. In itself, this was the moment he craved most, even beyond his own climax, the sound of his name tripping from her lips amidst the waves of her satisfaction. She'd been so shy the first few times they'd made love. Every time she said Gabriel in that ecstatic, breathy whisper, a precious warmth overtook him. "This is what love is," he thought. "Being naked and bare before one's lover, and unashamedly calling her name in need." In his own orgasm, he reciprocated, telling her that he loved her. It was inextricably linked in his mind and experience. Sex and love and Julianne. The Holy Three. He held her tightly while they caught their breath, smiling to himself. He was so proud of her, so happy she could give voice to her desires, even when she was sad. He kissed her softly and was grateful to see that her smile had returned.
"Thank you," she whispered.
"Thank you, Julianne, for teaching me how to love." Paul walked into the departmental office on Wednesday and was shocked by what he saw. Julia was standing in front of the mailboxes, her skin pale and dull with dark circles under her eyes. As he made his way over to her, she lifted her head and smiled at him thinly. Her smile alone pained him. Before he could ask her what was wrong, Krista Peterson breezed in, her large Michael Kors bag dangling from her wrist. She looked remarkably well-rested, and her eyes were bright. She was wearing red, not cherry red or blood red, but scarlet, the color of triumph and power. She saw Paul and Julia together and cackled quietly. Paul's dark eyes shifted from Julia to Krista and back again. He watched as Julia hid her face while she checked her mailbox.
"What's wrong?" he whispered.
"Nothing. I think I'm coming down with a cold."
Paul shook his head. He would have pressed her, gently this time, but Professor Martin entered the office at that moment. Julia took one look at him and quickly picked up her messenger bag and her coat, hoping to make a break for the door. Paul stopped her.
"Would you like a cup of coffee? I was going to walk over to Starbucks."
Julia shook her head.
"I'm pretty tired. I think I need to go home."
Paul's eyes glanced down at her bare neck, her bare, unmarked neck, and moved back to her face.
"Is there anything I can do?" he asked.
"No. Thanks, Paul. I'm fine, really."
He nodded and watched her turn to leave, but before she could enter the hallway, he followed her.
"On second thought, I should head home now, too. I can walk with you if you want."
Julia bit her lip but nodded, and the two friends exited the building into the bone-chilling winter air. She wrapped her Magdalene College scarf around her neck, shivering against the wind.
"That's an Oxford scarf," Paul observed.
"Yes."
"Did you buy it in Oxford?"
No, it was a gift."
"Owen," he thought. "I guess he can't be a complete bonehead if he went to Oxford. Then again, Emerson went to Oxford." "I really like the Phillies cap you gave me. I'm a Red Sox fan, but I'll wear it with pride, except when I'm in Vermont. My dad would burn it if I wore it on the farm."
Julia couldn't help but smile, and Paul mirrored her expression.
"How long have you been sick?"
A few days," she shrugged uncomfortably.
"Have you been to the doctor?"
"It's just a cold. They wouldn't be able to do anything for me."
Paul stole glances at her while they walked past the Royal Ontario Museum, snowflakes swirling around them, and the crystal monstrosity that was the North Wall.
"Has Krista been hassling you? You seemed upset when she walked into the office."
Julia stumbled in the ankle-deep snow, and Paul quickly reached out one of his large paws to steady her.
"Careful. There could be black ice under there."
She thanked him and began to walk a little more slowly after he released her.
"If you slip again, grab hold of me. I don't go down. Ever."
She glanced at him sideways, completely innocently, only to see him blush. Julia had never seen a rugby player blush before. It was rumored to be impossible.
What I meant is that I'm too heavy. You wouldn't be able to pull me over."
She shook her head.
"You aren't that heavy."
Paul smiled to himself at the perceived compliment.
"Has Krista been rude to you?"
Julia looked down at the snow-covered sidewalk in front of them.
"I've been staying up late every night working on my thesis. Professor Picton is very demanding. Last week she rejected several pages of my Purgatorio translation. I've been redoing it, and it just takes so long."
"I could help you. I mean, you could email your translations to me before you give them to her so I could check them."
"Thanks, but you're busy with your own stuff. You don't have time for my problems."
He stopped walking and placed a light hand on her arm.
"Of course I have time for you. You're working on love and lust, and I'm working on pleasure. Some of our translations will overlap. It would be good practice for me."
"I'm not working on love and lust anymore.
Professor Picton made me change my topic to a comparison between courtly love and the friendship between Virgil and Dante.
Paul shrugged. Some of the translations will still overlap.
If we're working on the same passage, we could compare translations. I don't want to bother you with stuff that's unrelated to your project.
She looked over at him tentatively.
Send me what you have and what your deadlines are, and I'll look at it. No problem.
Thank you.
She appeared relieved. He withdrew his hand, and they began walking again.
Did you know that the chair of Italian studies sent out an email announcement about your admission to Harvard? He said that you won a pretty big fellowship.
Julia's eyes went wide.
No, I didn't know that. I didn't get that email.
Well, it was sent to everyone else. Emerson made me print out the email and post it on the bulletin board next to his office, after he insisted that I highlight all the important information, including your name, with a bright yellow marker.
Figures. He was nothing but rude to you while you were in his seminar, and now he's probably going to take credit for your admission to Harvard.
Asshole.
Julia's eyebrows furrowed, but she didn't comment.
What?
She flushed slightly under his scrutiny.
Nothing.
Julia, spit it out. What were you thinking just now?
I was just wondering if you'd seen Krista hovering around the department, or Professor Emerson's office?
No, thank God. It looks as if she's moved on to someone else. She knows better than to talk to me. I'm just waiting for her to give me a chance to tell her off.
Paul winked and patted her shoulder fraternally.
She better not give you a hard time, or I have a few stories I could tell.
On Thursday, Julia met with her therapist in preparation for her meeting with the dean, which was scheduled for Friday morning. Recognizing that Julia needed to discuss what was happening, Nicole set aside her goals for that session and listened patiently before offering her opinion.
Stress can be very destructive to our health, so it's important to deal with it adequately. Some people prefer to talk about their problems, while others prefer to think about them. How have you dealt with stress in the past?
Julia fidgeted with her hands.
I've kept quiet. Can you share your concerns with your boyfriend?
I can, but I don't want to upset him. He's worried about me as it is.
Nicole nodded sagely.
When you care about someone, it's understandable that you would want to protect them from pain, and that's perfectly appropriate on some occasions. But on others, you run the risk of shouldering more than your fair share of stress or responsibility. Can you see why that might be a problem?
Well, I don't like it when Gabriel keeps things from me. I feel like a child. I'd rather have him share things than shut me out.
It's possible that Gabriel feels the same way, that he worries about you shutting him out. Have you discussed this with him?
I've tried to. I've told him I want to be equals, that I don't want to keep secrets.
Good. And what was his response?
He either wants to take care of me or he's worried about disappointing me.
And how does that make you feel?
Julia gestured with her hands as she tried to find the words.
I don't want his money. It makes me feel poor and dependent and helpless.
And why is that?
He gives me so much already, and I can't reciprocate.
Is it important to you that your relationship be reciprocal?
Yes.
Nicole smiled kindly.
No relationship is absolutely reciprocal. Sometimes when couples try to split everything in half, they discover that the relationship is not a partnership, but a bean-counting exercise. Striving for reciprocity in a relationship can be unhealthy. On the other hand, striving to have a partnership in which each partner is valued equally and shares both burdens and responsibilities can be healthy. In other words, it isn't a problem if he makes more money than you, but he needs to understand that you want to contribute to the relationship, perhaps not financially, but in other ways, and that those ways should be respected just as much as the money.
Does that make sense?
Yes, I like that idea. A lot. As for protecting one another,
she smiled,
you could make a biological argument as to why men feel the need to protect their women and children. Whatever the reason, it's a fact. Men tend to find their self-worth in actions and accomplishments. If you refuse to let him do things for you, he'll feel useless and superfluous. He wants to know that he can take care of you and protect you, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Partners should want to protect one another. But like any view, it has its extremes, and it has its middle. What you and your boyfriend should do is to strive for the middle. Allow him to take care of you in some ways, while exerting your independence in others. And you should impress upon him the need for you to take care of him, too.
Julia nodded. The concept of moderation appealed to her. She wanted to care for Gabriel, and she wanted him to care for her. But she didn't want to be a burden, and she didn't want him to look at her as if she was broken. But sorting all of that out practically was a different matter.
Some men have what I call chivalry syndrome. They want to protect their women as if they were absolutely helpless. And this might be romantic and exciting for a time, but eventually reality will set in, and it will become stifling and patronizing. When one partner does all the protecting and the other does all the receiving, it's unhealthy. Of course, some women have the feminine equivalent of chivalry syndrome, wounded duck attachment. They seek out men who are bad boys or broken and afflicted and attempt to fix them. But we'll table that discussion for another day. At his extreme, a chivalrous male can do all kinds of rash things to protect his woman, including riding into battle on his horse or taking up arms against thousands of Persians when he should be running in the opposite direction. Discretion is the better part of valor, she chuckled slightly. Did you see the film 300?
Julia shook her head.
It's about the Battle of Thermopylae. When 300 Spartans held off 250,000 Persians before being defeated. Herodotus writes about it.
Julia regarded Nicole with no little interest. How many psychologists could cite Herodotus?
King Leonidas was an extreme case. One could argue that his last stand was precipitated by political concerns rather than chivalry. But my point is that sometimes the chivalrous man ends up doing more damage through his protection than can be done by the force threatening his partner. Spartan women used to tell their husbands and sons to come home carrying their shields on them. If you found yourself in that situation, you'd probably prefer that Gabriel didn't die holding the line against thousands of Persians and came home to you instead.
Julia nodded in absolute agreement.
In your conversations with Gabriel, you might want to talk about that. How you feel about being protected to his own detriment. How you should share your risks and responsibilities. Why you want to be a partner rather than a child or a helpless female. Perhaps Gabriel would be willing to attend joint sessions with us even though he isn't coming in privately.
Julia wasn't quite sure that she'd heard Nicole correctly.
Pardon?
Nicole smiled.
I said that in your conversations with Gabriel, you might want to talk about how you feel protected.
No, Julia interrupted.
I meant the last part. You said that Gabriel isn't coming in anymore?
Nicole froze.
That was very unprofessional of me. I shouldn't speak to you about another client and his counselor. When did he stop seeing Winston? I really can't say.
Nicole shifted in her seat.
Now we should probably discuss some ways in which you can deal with stress before your meeting tomorrow.
The Dean of Graduate Studies favored formality and refinement. For these reasons, he always conducted meetings in a large, wood-paneled conference room adjacent to his office on St. George Street. Professor Jeremy Martin, the chair of Italian Studies, sat at his right in a large, high-backed chair that was vaguely medieval in style, behind an imposing, dark wood table that ran almost the width of the room. Two small folding chairs were centered before the table, and that is where Soraya and her client sat most uncomfortably at the beginning of their meeting.
A moment for introductions,
The dean's rich baritone voice rang out in the room.
Miss Julianne Mitchell?
Julian nodded, but said nothing.
And who is your representative?
His pale, cold blue eyes gave away nothing, but it was clear that he recognized the dark-haired woman at Julia's left.
Soraya Harandi, Dr. Aris. I will be representing Miss Mitchell.
Is there a reason why Miss Mitchell has elected to bring an attorney to this informal meeting?
It was clear that he was already irritated.
Why, Dr. Aris, my client was simply following your instructions. You suggested she retain a lawyer in your letter.
Soraya's voice was deceptively sweet. David resisted the urge to growl at her, for he did not like being made a fool. He gestured to the man beside him.
This is Professor Martin.
Julia took a moment to appraise the chair's appearance. She knew that he would be meeting with Gabriel to discuss Krista's harassment complaint after this meeting concluded. She tried very hard to discern his disposition, but found herself puzzled. His demeanor was decidedly neutral, at least toward her.
The dean cleared his throat. We have received a very serious complaint about you, Miss Mitchell. Our purpose in inviting you to speak to us today is solely for information purposes as we begin our investigation. We will ask a few questions. Then you will have the opportunity to ask questions of us. I hope the meeting will terminate in about 30 minutes.
Julia inhaled slowly, watching him and waiting.
Are you having a romantic relationship with Professor Gabriel Emerson?
Julia's eyes bugged out of her head, and her jaw dropped open. Before she could speak, Soraya jumped in.
My client will not answer any questions until the substance of the complaint is revealed. The letter was understandably vague, given the policies of the university. But you have passed the point of vagueness with that question. Exactly what is the complaint against my client? What is the evidence for the complaint, and who is the complainant?
David tapped a finger at the glass water pitcher in front of him, making the slices of lemon dance to his drumming.
That is not how these meetings work. I am the dean. I ask the questions.
Dr. Aris.
Soraya's voice took on an almost patronizing tone.
We both know that the policies and procedures assumed by the university are governed by the principles of natural justice. My client deserves to know the specifics of the complaint, the nature and scope of the evidence against her, if any, and the identity of the complainant before she answers any questions. Otherwise, this is an unjust proceeding, and I will have no choice but to file a complaint to that effect, immediately.
I have to agree with Miss Harandi, said Professor Martin quietly. David gave Jeremy an annoyed look out of the corner of his eye.
Very well. An allegation of graduate student misconduct reached our office concerning your client. It was alleged that she entered into a sexual relationship with one of her professors for the purpose of procuring academic favors.
Julia's eyes grew wide and round. Soraya laughed, loudly.
This is a farce. My client is an extremely talented student who was recently offered an early acceptance to Harvard, as you well know.
She nodded in Professor Martin's direction.
My client doesn't need to prostitute herself.
The allegation is not without precedent at this institution, Miss Harandi, and we take all complaints seriously as dictated by our policies.
Then why isn't the complaint being processed as a sexual harassment case? Surely if a student initiates a transaction in which favors are exchanged for sex, it would count as sexual harassment.
That avenue of inquiry is also being explored, David snapped.
Soraya chuckled.
Fine, fine. What are the alleged favors?
A high mark in a seminar in which the professor was the instructor. Financial payments in the form of a bursary, and the procurement of an established, retired scholar to direct Miss Mitchell's thesis.
Soraya waved a dismissive hand, almost yawning in boredom.
I reiterate the fact that my client's academic merits speak for themselves. And who, pray tell, is the unfortunate professor?
David watched Julia closely.
Gabriel Emerson.
Soraya smiled widely.
Your complainant has a wild imagination.
He or she must be majoring in fiction. Did Professor Emerson file the complaint?
Julia held her breath, horrified as she waited for David's answer. He tapped the papers in front of him with the end of his pen.
No, he did not.
Well, what was his testimony when you spoke with him?
We intend to speak with Professor Emerson once we have gathered more information. Our protocols dictate that faculty members who are a party to a complaint are brought in last, not first. Professor Martin spoke for the first time, his voice firm but calm. Soraya fixed him with a stern eye.
So, in the hierarchy of the university, female graduate students are preyed upon first, and only afterward the professor, whose testimony could exonerate her, is approached? I'm shocked that you would drag my client in here without the courtesy of even attempting to speak to the other person involved. This entire matter could have been put to rest with two telephone calls. This is a disgrace.
David began to protest, but Soraya interrupted him again.
Before we end this meeting, who is the complainant?
The complainant is a person who I believe is known to Miss Mitchell. Her name is Krista Peterson.
Soraya received the news impassively, but Julia's eyes flew to Professor Martin's. It was one quick movement, but he noticed it and stared straight back at her with knitted brows. Blushing, she looked down at her hands.
David held up two pieces of paper. Based on our preliminary investigation, it seems that Professor Emerson awarded a very high mark to Miss Mitchell in his graduate seminar. She was awarded the M.P. Emerson Bursary, which was mysteriously donated by an American foundation after Miss Mitchell began the program. And Professor Martin has provided me with Miss Mitchell's academic file, in which it shows that Catherine Picton was approached by Professor Emerson last semester to replace him as Miss Mitchell's thesis supervisor.
He passed a file over to Soraya.
As you will see, Miss Hirandi, that file contains additional evidence provided by Miss Peterson. It includes a series of photographs and news clippings from a Florentine newspaper showing Miss Mitchell and Professor Emerson at a public event in Italy, where Professor Emerson is quoted as saying that Miss Mitchell is his fiancée. And there is a sworn statement by an employee of a local club who claims to possess security videos that show personal interactions between Miss Mitchell and Professor Emerson at that club during the time that she was his student. These interactions appear to be of an intimate nature and certainly go well beyond the appropriate boundaries of a professional relationship.
He paused for effect.
It's possible that the evidence provided by the complainant could be proof of more than one infraction. So for this reason, we are eager to hear Miss Mitchell's side of the story. So I ask you again, did you receive special academic favors from your professor because of your personal relationship with him?
Dr. Aris, I am astonished that a man of your stature would be persuaded to give credence to a complaint that not only strains credulity, but is supported by the very flimsiest of evidence. Newspaper clippings from an Italian tabloid? Videos that cannot be authenticated? There is no prima facie case, none whatsoever.
Don't question my competency, Miss Hirandi.
The dean's swift temper got the best of him.
I've been working in higher education since you were in kindergarten.
Soraya raised her eyebrows at him and closed the file ceremoniously, tossing it onto his desk.
What kind of interest does the complainant have in making such an allegation?
David glared. Soraya looked from the dean to the chair and back again.
Perhaps the complainant's true target is Professor Emerson. Why am I suddenly getting the impression that my client is collateral damage?
Any other matters are outside your purview, Miss Hirandi.
The dean's chin began to wobble.
Even if this office would prefer to ignore the supporting information filed with the complaint, we can't. The newspaper article demonstrates that Miss Mitchell and Professor Emerson were romantically linked only days after the end of the semester. It appears to demonstrate the existence of a prior, inappropriate relationship, if nothing else.
I can't believe you summoned my client to listen to these bizarre accusations. The complainant is clearly unstable and living in a fantasy world. If she has an issue with Professor Emerson, she needs to pursue a complaint against him, not my client.
Given what I have seen here today, I will advise my client that she is well within her rights to file a harassment complaint against Miss Peterson, and to see that she is investigated for making a fraudulent and defamatory charge."
The dean cleared his throat noisily.
"If your position is such that Miss Mitchell and Professor Emerson engaged in a consensual relationship, I will gladly make note of such a declaration, and we can dispense with the charade. When did this consensual relationship begin?"
"The only charade is the one your office is performing, in which you attempt to appear to be investigating an academic infraction, but rather are engaging in some kind of prurient sexual McCarthyism. This meeting is over."
Soraya closed her briefcase dramatically and stood to her feet.
"Just a minute, Miss Harandi. If you had troubled yourself to take a closer look at Miss Mitchell's academic file, you'd have seen a form signed by Professor Picton and dated in October, declaring that she would be supervising Miss Mitchell's thesis because Professor Emerson had a conflict of interest. What reason would he have to approach Professor Picton other than giving Miss Mitchell what she wanted? What kind of conflict of interest could there be other than an inappropriate relationship?"
Julia opened her mouth to answer him to reveal the fact that she had known Gabriel since she was a teenager, but Soraya grabbed her forearm in a death grip.
"You sound as if you have already taken a position on the complaint, Dr. Aris. Perhaps your letter would have been less disingenuous if you had stated that your true purpose in this meeting was to poison the well against my client so you could punish her."
The dean appeared to swallow his growing anger. He gestured to the paperwork in front of him.
"The complaint alleges that academic favors were granted to Miss Mitchell for reasons other than academic performance. The complainant testifies that Professor Emerson and Miss Mitchell engaged in a lover's quarrel in front of a room full of witnesses during one of his seminars. Shortly after that embarrassing public display, Professor Picton signed the paperwork that allowed her to become Miss Mitchell's thesis advisor. Quid pro quo, quod erat demonstrandum."
"Nemo me impune lacessit, Dr. Aris."
Soraya smiled at Professor Martin before turning a stony gaze in David's direction. "I started studying Latin when I was in kindergarten. The complaint is malicious and false. If the provost decides to lay charges on the basis of this complaint, I will pursue other avenues of remedy against the complainant and this office."
Julia watched as the dean gripped his pen rather tightly. "Are you sure this is the position you wish to make, Miss Mitchell? An argument for leniency can be made if you cooperate."
"You've basically called my client a whore and accused her of sleeping with a professor to gain a preferment. I don't need to remind you of the laws regarding defamation of character. I believe we found ourselves in a similar situation last year. We don't give in to threats."
"We do not threaten. We adjudicate. We will be interviewing witnesses and other relevant parties, and then we will repeat this conversation. Jeremy, have you any further comments or questions?"
Professor Martin measured Julianne with his gaze, then shook his head dispassionately. The dean closed his file.
"Since you refuse to answer my questions, Miss Mitchell, you are dismissed."
Soraya nodded at the two men and escorted Julia out of the room.
Chapter 21. "That meeting was a confederacy of dunces," announced Soraya, leaning against the banquette in the bar of the Windsor Arms Hotel. Julia nodded, wondering if she was Ignatius Riley, the protagonist of that book, or whether Gabriel was Ignatius and she was Myrna Minkoff. The bartender delivered their martinis with a smile and a few dishes of tapas on the house. He winked at Soraya, who was a regular, and returned to the bar. She took a long sip of her drink and settled herself in her seat.
"My advice is to file a harassment complaint against Krista Peterson, citing malicious intent as soon as possible. There are provisions in the university's academic policies that are supposed to protect students from fraudulent accusations."
"I'm not sure I want to antagonize her."
Soraya laughed darkly.
"What more could she do to you? Boil your bunny?"
Julia cringed.
"Listen.
A complaint against her would be a shot across the bow. We don't have to follow through on it, but it would give her and the dean something to think about. You told me that she accused Gabriel of sexual harassment. Don't you want to strike back?
I want all of this to end. I don't understand how she can file a complaint against me when my situation has nothing to do with her.
Based on what we learned today, I think it's pretty clear what she's doing. She accused you of sleeping your way to the top, and she accused your boyfriend of trying to make the same arrangement with her. It's clever, really, because she doesn't need her complaints to be successful in order to take both of you out at the same time.
Julia blanched.
What do you mean?
She's forcing you into admitting that you had a relationship with your professor. Then the university can hit you and him with a fraternization charge. She's either brilliant or she's had some coaching.
Julia traced a finger up and down the side of her martini glass, fighting the urge to be sick. Soraya sipped her cocktail once more.
I need you to make a list of people the dean might interview, and anything they might say that would be damaging.
The evidence he has is slight, but if you put it all together, it could be enough to convince a tribunal that Gabriel gifted you with favors because of your relationship.
Julia began sawing on her lower lip with her teeth.
Don't worry yet. Let's focus on beating this complaint and worry about everything else later. The administration is very cautious when it comes to matters involving faculty members because of their union. The university will continue the investigation until they're sure, and then they'll pounce. In the meantime, let me file a complaint against this Krista Peterson character. From now on, you and Gabriel need to stay out of the public eye. David will be investigating both of you this week, and we should assume he'll interview everyone who has come in contact with both of you.
Julia shook her head, a wave of nausea crashing over her as she thought of other faculty members and students from the department being asked to give testimony in front of the dean.
All right, Soraya. File the complaint.
I don't think it will accomplish anything other than to antagonize her, but you're the lawyer.
Excellent. Soraya smiled widely and downed the rest of her dirty martini. Later that afternoon, Julia was exiting the elevator on Gabriel's floor. She passed his French-Canadian neighbor as she walked down the long hallway and they exchanged a brief but friendly nod. Then she let herself in with her key.
Julianne, is that you?
Yes. How was your meeting with the chair?
She quickly removed her coat and boots and was ready to walk into the living room when Gabriel met her in the front hall. I want to hear about your meeting first. He placed his hands on her shoulders and kissed her forehead.
Are you all right? What happened? They asked me a few questions and let me go.
He let out an expletive and pulled her into his arms. If anything ever happened to you. She returned his embrace, exhaling slowly against his dress shirt.
It was Krista Peterson.
What? He pulled back so he could see her face.
Krista accused me of exchanging sexual favors with you for academic benefits.
What? While Julia hurriedly described the nature of the complaint and David and Soraya's exchanges, Gabriel's expression grew darker and more dangerous. When she quoted David's final words, he took a large step away from her. He reared back and thrust his fist through the wall. Then, for good measure, he withdrew, dragging fragments of plaster and dust with him, before punching through the wall twice more in rapid succession. Julia stood open-mouthed as Gabriel trembled before her, eyes closed and chest heaving. Part of her wanted to run, but she found herself rooted to the spot. No matter how much she wanted to run at that moment, the sight of a few drops of blood dripping from his knuckles and onto the hardwood floor captured her attention.
What have you done to yourself?
She looked up into his blazing eyes and pulled him toward the guest washroom.
Sit down.
Once he was situated, she examined his knuckles and found the skin had split in more than one place.
You might need stitches, she said. I'm worried you've broken something.
Gabriel opened and closed his hand several times, wordlessly demonstrating that his hand wasn't broken.
I think you should have an X-ray, just in case.
His only response was to rub at his eyes with his uninjured hand and heave a deep, shuddering sigh. She opened the medicine cabinet and removed a few first aid items.
I'll try to clean this, but you should go to the hospital.
I'll be fine.
His voice was tight. Using tweezers, she removed the bits of plaster from his wounds and cleaned them with iodine. Gabriel barely flinched as she bathed his knuckles, and she noticed that he was shaking, possibly from residual anger.
I'm sorry I upset you, Julia whispered.
I nearly brought a wall down, and you're apologizing to me?
I should have told you when you were sitting down or after you'd had a drink.
He shook his head. Then I really would have knocked the wall down. I'm too angry to drink.
Julia continued her first aid until the wound was completely clean. When she was finished, she ghosted her lips over his bandaged knuckles.
I'm so sorry.
Gabriel caught her hand in his. Stop it. I seem to remember another time in this washroom when I was the one playing doctor.
I was mortified. I wanted to make a good impression, and then I smashed your crystal and sprayed your nice shirt with Chianti.
It was an accident. I had to work up the courage to put iodine on your cuts. I was afraid of hurting you. And that was before I...
He closed his eyes and rubbed at them again. What happened to you today is my fault. I should have protected you.
Gabriel,
Julia said, her voice a warning. She leaned over and took his face between her hands, forcing him to look at her.
Don't. We knew the risks when we got involved. I don't care what they do to me.
Her voice broke on the words, but she spoke them anyway.
I don't care about Harvard or my PhD. I don't want to lose you.
A strange fire illuminated Gabriel's eyes.
Not even hell could keep me from you, he whispered.
The lovers embraced desperately, drawing comfort from each other's very skin.
Are you going to tell me what happened with Professor Martin?
Gabriel took Julia's hand and led her into the master bedroom where he began drawing a bath.
You relax. I'll talk.
I'm not in the mood for a bubble bath. I kind of feel like taking a crowbar to something.
Something appalling and poorly made.
Like domestic beer.
That's why you need a bubble bath. I have to preserve the walls of my apartment.
Julia undressed and settled herself amongst the suds. He regarded her intensely. The way her long hair was pinned up haphazardly on top of her head. The gentle contours of her breasts floating amidst the water like two white, pink-tipped lilies. The way she bit at her lip until she realized he was staring at it.
Do you remember the first time we bathed together?
She asked as she watched him settle his tall form on a low stool.
I'm not likely to forget it.
You were worried I was hurting, and you carried me to the tub.
She smiled shyly.
That was one of the kindest things you've ever done for me.
Thank you.
He gave her a peck on her cheek. But I can't reminisce about happy things with you. I'm far too angry for that. I'd like to rip out David Eris's tongue and strangle him with it.
What about Professor Martin?
Gabriel paused, clearing his throat. If Krista's complaint had stood alone, he would have interviewed me, perhaps spoken to a few others around the department, and concluded that her charge was fabricated. Her complaint against you, however, complicates things.
What did your lawyer say?
I decided to meet with Jeremy alone. Julia sat bolt upright, the water sloshing around her.
What? I thought you told your lawyer about the complaint so he would accompany you.
Gabriel leaned forward, resting his forearms on his knees.
Jeremy hired me. I consider him a friend.
I thought it was more likely that we could cut through the bullshit and deal with the issue if I didn't bring my lawyer.
Julia's eyes widened in disbelief.
What did he say?
Krista claims that I tried to initiate a sexual relationship with her on a number of different occasions, including meetings that we had on and off campus. She mentioned our interactions at Starbucks and at Lobby.
His eyes shifted to Julia's.
She is also accusing me of punishing her by rejecting her thesis proposal and threatening to have her dismissed from the PhD program. She claims that after she spurned me, I made her life hell.
But it's all lies. She was the one harassing you.
Exactly.
and I said as much.
Jeremy was quite cross. He told me that I should have come to him immediately and filed a complaint. Obviously, my claim is not very credible at this point. But there are a couple of things that Krista did not take into consideration.
Such as?
Her academic file. Jeremy and I had at least two discussions about her poor progress over the course of last semester. He was well aware of the fact that she was struggling. Notes from those discussions, along with copies of her work, are in her file. Also, Paul was present during some of my interactions with Krista. I suggested that Jeremy speak with him, along with Mrs. Jenkins.
Paul was with me in Starbucks the day you met with Krista. She told us she was planning on persuading you to take her to lobby, that she was going to be exchanging more than names with you that evening.
Gabriel's eyebrows furrowed.
What? I forgot about that conversation, or I would have mentioned it earlier. Paul and I were having coffee, and Krista came in before you arrived. She was bragging about how she was going to seduce you.
Gabriel stroked his chin, deep in thought. And Paul heard her say this?
Yes, said Julia, fighting a smile. I guess the angel fucker might turn out to be a guardian angel.
Gabriel scowled. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. What else did she say?
Not much. We saw you meet with Krista, but we were too far away to hear what you were saying. Her body language seemed pretty obvious. She was trying to flirt with you, and you scolded her. I could tell Professor Martin that.
Absolutely not. You're too involved as it is.
He scratched at his chin once again. Jeremy asked that I not speak to Paul about Krista. The situation is a bit touchy because Paul is working for me, but Jeremy agreed to talk to him. It would be best if you didn't speak to Paul about this either. The less said on the topic, the better.
He doesn't like Krista. One of the first things he ever said to me was that she wanted to become Mrs. Emerson. He knows she was after you.
Gabriel grimaced. I reminded Jeremy that I approved Krista's dissertation proposal back in December, after giving her numerous chances to fix it. Let's hope that when he talks to Paul, he's able to grasp a clear picture of what actually happened. Julia closed her eyes, resting her head back in the bathtub. She knew that they could rely on Paul to tell the truth. Despite his antipathy to Professor Emerson, he wouldn't give credence to Krista's false allegations. Gabriel stood up. There's one other thing I need to tell you.
What's that?
Julia asked, eyes still closed. Jeremy asked if we were involved, and I said, yes. She opened her eyes, staring up at him.
What?
I told him that we didn't get involved until the Christmas break. Gabriel's expression grew tense.
Did he believe you?
He seemed to, but he was angry. He told me I should have come to him immediately. He said that he was obligated to report me to the dean for failing to follow university policy.
Oh, no.
Julia reached for Gabriel's hand.
What are we going to do?
He said that because of our other troubles, he isn't going to muddy the waters, for now. But he was adamant in telling me that he wasn't going to cover things up. Gabriel leaned over to kiss her forehead.
Don't worry about Jeremy. I'll handle him.
While you're finishing your bath, I'll update my lawyer so we can plan our next move. He smiled and turned to leave.
Gabriel, there is one more thing. Well, two more things, actually.
Soraya is filing a complaint against Krista on my behalf, arguing that she targeted me maliciously.
Good. Maybe that will cause her to rethink her actions.
And in my meeting with Nicole yesterday, she mentioned that you weren't in therapy anymore. Gabriel saw Julia's expression, one of irritation mixed with sadness, and his shoulders slumped.
Chapter 22. In the grand scheme of things, Gabriel's failure to mention the fact that he'd stopped going to therapy was unimportant, or so Julia believed. They argued about it briefly, but both of them were too worried about their troubles with the university to do more than that. Gabriel received a terse note from Jeremy the following week, indicating that he'd interviewed both Mrs. Jenkins and Paul.
Other than that, he and Julia didn't receive any communication from the university. David Aris spent his Friday night alone in the office of his house with a bottle of Jameson whiskey. It was not unusual for him to do so. In his position as Dean of Graduate Studies, he often brought work home. On this particular evening, he found himself mired in a very tricky, very sensitive situation. Miss Peterson's harassment complaint had been challenged by the testimony of more than one witness. However, the academic fraud complaint against Miss Mitchell had alerted him to a possible case of fraternization between Julia and Professor Emerson. The problem was that the evidence was contradictory. According to the information passed on by Professor Martin, Paul Norris had painted a glowing picture of Miss Mitchell and her character. As the whiskey burned his throat, David wondered if all women Mr. Norris came in contact with had mysteriously sprouted wings, or if he simply had a weakness for young women from Selinsgrove, Pennsylvania, wherever the hell that was. According to Mr. Norris and Mrs. Jenkins, Miss Mitchell was a timid young woman who was disliked by Professor Emerson. Mr. Norris went further to claim that the professor had fought openly with her in his seminar. Subsequent to the confrontation in class, Emerson had approached Professor Picton to supervise Miss Mitchell's thesis, citing the fact that she was a friend of his family as the reason why he could no longer continue to supervise her. Here is where David was puzzled. Professor Emerson hadn't objected to Miss Mitchell's admission to the program, knowing that he was the only professor who directed theses on Dante. If there was such an obvious conflict of interest, why hadn't he objected, or declared the conflict of interest to Professor Martin at the beginning of the semester? The files on Professor Emerson and Miss Mitchell did not make sense, and David did not like it when things did not make sense, for his universe was nothing if not sensical. As he pondered the evidence, he inserted a flash drive into his computer. He opened the single folder on the drive and began scanning through the emails that had been culled obligingly from Professor Emerson's account by someone in the Information Technology office. He adjusted the parameters to include only those messages that had been sent to or received from Miss Mitchell, Miss Peterson, Mr. Norris, and Professor Picton. In a few minutes, David found something that surprised him. On his screen were emails that had been sent before the end of October 2009. The first email had been written by Professor Emerson to Miss Mitchell. "Dear Miss Mitchell, I need to speak to you concerning a matter of some urgency. Please contact me as soon as possible. You may telephone me at the following number, 416-555-0739, cell. Regards, Professor Gabriel O. Emerson, Associate Professor, Department of Italian Studies, Center for Medieval Studies, University of Toronto." The second email was sent by Miss Mitchell to Professor Emerson in response to his message. "Dr. Emerson, stop harassing me. I don't want you anymore. I don't even want to know you. If you don't leave me alone, I will be forced to file a harassment complaint against you. And if you call my father, I will do just that, immediately. If you think I'm going to let an insignificant thing like this drive me from the program, then you are very much mistaken. I need a new thesis director, not a bus ticket home. Regards, Miss J. H. Mitchell, lowly graduate student, on knees more than the average whore. P.S. I will be returning the M.P. Emerson bursary next week. Congratulations, Professor Avalar. No one has ever made me feel as cheap as you did Sunday morning." The dean straightened in his chair. He read the two emails once again, examining every word. Although he had a vague memory of who Peter Abelard was, he indulged his curiosity and Googled him. He clicked on a reputable biography and began reading. "Quod erat demonstrandum," he thought.